So in this parsha, we have, of course, the story of the Meraglim, which eventually had a very tragic ending, that the Jewish people had to wander in the desert for another 38 and a half years. Remember, when we say 40 years, we don't mean from the time of the Meraglim. It's 40 years of wandering from the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and the story of the Meraglim happened a year and a half after we left Mitzrayim. And Rashi raises a fundamental question. Whose idea was it to send the Meraglim? And there actually is a contradiction in the Chumash itself. In Parsha Shalach, Hashem says to Moshe, Shalach lecha, send Meraglim. It seems to be a divine command. In the book of Devarim, where Moshe Rabbeinu is reviewing the story after 40 years, Moshe Rabbeinu said, Vatikravun elai kulchem. You came to me, you the people came to me, and you said, Nishlecha Anashim Lefanenu, we want to send spies, let us send spies. So was it Hashem that commanded, or was it a demand of the people? It's a contradiction. So Rashi answers the contradiction by reinterpreting the phrase, Shalach Lecha, that when it says in this parsha, Shalach Lecha, you shall send spies, it is not a command. It is simply saying, well, if they want it, you have my permission to send the spies. But it's a very strange idea. God is saying, you can send them if you want, but it's not a good idea. So it's a little strange. Why does Moshe, Hashem basically tells Moshe, I'm not going to usher it, but it's not a good thing. And that's how Rashi reconciles the contradiction. So according to Rashi, it turns out the following. According to Rashi, the sin of the Meraglim is not only the report that they brought back, that for sure is a chait, but the etzem shiluach of the Meraglim is considered to be a chait, because if they truly had faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's promise that they would conquer the land, they would have no reason to send spies to see the military targets and the like. Now, this is important. According to Rashi, it is the shiluach ha-meraglim that is a chait, as well as the lashon hara that the meraglim brought back. The Ramban is strongly cholek on Rashi, because the Ramban says it's a davar pashut that sending spies is not inconsistent with emuna. Even if I believe that Hashem is the source of my victory, I am still mechuyev to wage war. I am mechuyev to have an army. And as a result, I need to know the weaknesses of the enemy and the place to attack and the like. This is called hishtadlus. Hishtadlus is never a contradiction, the Ramban says, to Amunah. If I go get a job, is it because I don't believe that Hashem will give me parnasa? No, Hashem gives me parnasa, but Hashem says I have to make some effort. Now again, whether it's a job, whether it's a kollel check, whatever it is, I'm not making any speech against kollel, chas v'shalom. But all I'm saying is that emunah always requires that we engage in ishtadlus. And the Ramban says, shiluach ha-meraglim is just a particular method of ishtadlus, because you're going to have an army. In fact, that's how we conquered Eretz Yisrael. We conquered Eretz Yisrael through a military procedure. So when you have an army, you have spies that tell you where to go. And the Ramban brings a beautiful raya. Because if you're going to say that the etzem shiluach ha-meraglim was a chait and a chisaron in emuna, in the Torah itself, after this maisa, after Hashem decrees that you're all going to die in the desert, when we fought Sichon, Melech Amori, that those were the last wars we had before Moshe Rabbeinu's death, Eivor LiYarden, the pasuk says, Moshe sent spies. I mean, the Jewish people had just been declared that they were going to die in the desert because of spies, and now Moshe sends spies. The Ramban says it's muchrach that there is no aveira to send spies. That is called ishtadlus. And in fact, Yoshua ben Nun sent spies before he conquered Jericho. So because of this, the Ramban's shita is that there is no aveira in shiluach ha-meraglim. And shalach lecha, God is not saying, well, do it, but it's not a good idea. Rather, it's okay, it's legitimate. The only aveira was the report the Meraglim brought back and the reaction of the people that we're not going to be able to succeed. That's an aveira, because that's saying I don't have emuna in Hashem's promise. But the etzem shiluach hameraglim is not a chet. Okay, so this is a big machlokas Rashi and the Ramban. But the nitziv, right, the nitziv of Shiva Volozhin, Rav Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, right, that's the nitziv, little history here. Let me give you a tiny bit of history, just so you put these gedolim in perspective. You know, we commonly say that the first yeshiva was the yeshiva of Volozhin in Lita, in Belarus, actually, that was founded by Rav Chaim of Volozhin, the Vilna Gaon's Talmud. Now, what do we mean, the first yeshiva? What does that mean? The Gemara says there were yeshivas from the time of Avraham Avinu. And in the time of the Tanoim and the Amoraim, there were certainly yeshivas. So what do we mean, the first yeshiva? So the basic idea is that, of course, there were always yeshivas in Klal Yisrael. There always were people learning Torah. There were always people who taught Torah. But Volozhin, most yeshivas were very local, meaning to say in every city there was a Beis Medrash, or maybe more than a Beis Medrash, more than one, where people would learn. And usually there wouldn't even be a Rebbe giving a shir, but sometimes there was. But Volozhin was an international yeshiva. Volozhin was a center that attracted people from Germany and from Poland and from Hungary and even from the United States, very few. A few people came to the Volozhin yeshiva. And Volozhin is called the mother of yeshivas, because when Volozhin was closed by the Russian government in the 1890s. And the whole story, why was Volozhin closed? But the story that's mukubal, though some people have questioned the story, was that the Russian government was trying to modernize Jewish life by essentially getting rid of religion. This is under the Tsar. This is before the Russian Revolution. And they required yeshivas to introduce secular studies. And the story goes that the Nitziv decided it would be better to close down the Volozhin yeshiva totally than to introduce mandatory secular studies under the supervision of the Russian government, because they saw this as an attempt to destroy and undermine the yeshiva. So Volozhin was closed, but in the aftermath of Volozhin, the yeshivas like Mir, Slobodka, Panovich, Kamenetz, Baranovich, all the great, great yeshivas that we know really come from Volozhin. And so Volozhin is called the mother of the yeshivas. Now, the founding Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin was the Nitziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Rav Chaim Volozhin. But the Rosh Yeshiva who led the Volozhin for the longest period of time was a person who married the granddaughter of Rav Chaim Volozhin, and that was the Nitziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. And he was Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin for almost 50 years. But what's interesting is, Volozhin had a tradition of having two Rosh Yeshivas. A senior Rosh Yeshiva, the head Rosh Yeshiva, and the second Rosh Yeshiva. So for 12 of those years, the secondary Rosh Yeshiva was none other than Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's first position, before he became the Rav of Brisk, was he was the junior Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. And that was the greatest years of Volozhin. People were enchanted and entranced and almost hypnotized by the depth of Rav Chaim's limud. The Nitziv's derech, the Nitziv was a tremendous guy in Bataira. The Nitziv was a master of Bavli, Yerushalmi, all the Midrashim, all the Rishonim. Achronim too, but Achronim was not his forte, but certainly all the Rishonim, and including Zohar and Kabbalah, the Nitziv knew everything. And the Nitziv Shiurim were based on his bringing together all aspects of Torah. But Rav Chaim Shiurim were based more on the depth of his Sforim. And since everybody in Volozhin was pretty brilliant, Volozhin did not have average Talmidim at all. So Rav Chaim was the big attraction. And these were Rav Chaim's probably happiest years of his life. He then eventually became the Rav of Brisk when his father, the Beis Halevi, died, etc. And shortly afterwards, Volozhin closed down anyway, and the Nitziv died. And in Warsaw, the Nitziv and Rav Chaim are buried right next to each other. You may wonder, why are they in Warsaw? Well, many, many Gedolim are buried in Warsaw, because when they got sick towards the end of their lives, they would go to the big city of Warsaw for medical treatment, and many of them died there. So Warsaw has a collection of Gedolim from all over Europe. Okay. Now the Nitziv, in addition to his other Svarim, wrote a Perish on Chumash, called HaMikdavar. Because the Nitziv was not only the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, the Nitziv was also the Rav of the city of Volozhin. And as Rav, he would go to the main shul every day, and he would give a shir in Chumash to Balabatim, which was very unusual for a Rosh Yeshiva. And the notes of the shir became his commentary, HaMikdavar. And this is what he says. The Nitziv goes through a compromise between Rashi and the Ramban, and he develops the following idea. Something objectively might be an Aveira. It might be something wrong. But when you're on a certain Madrega where you're not high enough to live by the highest standard, then not only can you do the thing that's wrong, but you need to do the thing that's wrong. The concept of the Nitziv is the following. If people were truly Maminim in Hashem, they would, like he learns like Rashi, they wouldn't need Meraglim. But the very fact that they ask shows they're not on the Madrega of Emunah. And once they're not on the Madrega of Emunah, that which shouldn't have been needed becomes mandatory, because Hashem's protection over you is a function of how strong your Emunah is. The stronger your Emunah, the less your need for Hishtadlus. The weaker your Emunah, the more you need Hishtadlus. If the Jews wouldn't have asked for spies, they wouldn't have needed spies. But the very fact that they asked meant they were living in a world where they had to follow natural law. He brings the following raya to this yisait. If you remember, those of you that learned the book of Shmuel, if you haven't learned the book of Shmuel, you should learn the book of Shmuel, may recall that at some point after Shaul was rejected by Hashem because he did not fulfill the commandment of eradicating Amalek, so Shmuel was told to go to Beis Lechem, go to Bethlehem, and anoint one of Yishai's children to be king. He didn't even know which one. So Shmuel asked Hashem, Eich Eilech, how can I go to Beis Lechem? Shaul is going to hear that I'm going to anoint a successor to him, and Shaul is going to kill me. How could I do this? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Shmuel, well, go under a pretense. Because in those days there was no Beis HaMikdash, so people could bring a korban wherever they wanted, a bama. So go and take an animal and act as if you're just bringing a korban there, and Shaul is not going to know why you're coming. And the Gemara darshins from here, an important halacha, that even though we have a klal, Shaluchei mitzvah einam nizakim, that people who are doing a mitzvah are not going to get hurt, but where it's a dangerous situation, and it's dangerous to do something that's going to incite the volatile temper of Shaul, so you're not given that protection. The fact that you're going through a mitzvah does not mean you can cross against a red light or go through a red light or whatever it is, because that's something which creates a high probability of danger. And you cannot rely on the promise, Shaluchei mitzvah einam nizakim, and that's why God had to give him away, that it wouldn't be dangerous. But Frek the Nitziv, why did Hashem give him this Eitzah only if Shmuel asked? Shmuel said, Shaul's going to kill me. Let's say he wouldn't have asked, but if it's a dangerous situation, Hashem should have told him, when you go, take the korban. You hear the kasha? So the Nitziv's answer is, had Shmuel not been afraid, had he felt Hashem is sending me, there is nothing to be afraid of, he wouldn't have needed to engage in bringing a korban. But because he was afraid, because he did not believe 100%, in spite of Shmuel's greatness, that is Shokol Kamosha V'Aaron. Right? Shmuel is equal to Moshe and Aaron. But despite his greatness, Shmuel had a pachad. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if Shmuel has a pachad, his emunah is not full, he is now mechuyav to do things that he otherwise wouldn't have had to do. So the Nitziv says, the Meraglim is exactly that particular maisa. Meaning, Had the Jewish people had Emunah Shleima, they wouldn't have needed Meraglim. They would have come in and the enemy just would have fallen before them. Like, you know, the wind blowing down the weeds. But because they're afraid, so now it's not a contradiction. The impetus came from them, that's what the Book of Devarim says. But Shalach Lecha, it's now a mitzvah. You now have to do it. By the way, the same thing is true. I'll give you a third example. So we have Meraglim, we have the example of Shmuel and Shaul. A third example is the mitzvah of a king. And this is a famous, famous question the Mefarshim ask. Again, from the Book of Shmuel, many, many good, interesting things, like every Sefer of Tanakh, but you learn from the Book of Shmuel. Towards the end of Shmuel's life, this is before Shaul was chosen, right? People come to Shmuel and say, we want a king to be judged like all of the Goyim. We want a king. And if you remember, Shmuel gave them a long Musar Shmuz. Why do you need a king? Hashem is your king. You think a king is good. A king is going to enslave you and a king is going to tax you and you know, you are rebelling against Hashem. That you need a king of Basar V'dam, flesh and blood. And even though he had a grand finale, he called upon a lightning storm in the middle of Nisan, a hailstorm, to show, this is what Hashem thinks of your desire. There was storm and lightning. Right? So it seems to be that asking for a king was a sin, was not a good thing. And yet, we read in Sefer Devarim, Parsha Shoftim, that when you come to the land, you have a chiyuv, you have a mitzvah to appoint a king. A mitzvah to appoint a king. In fact, the Rambam says it's one of the 613 mitzvahs. Som tasim alecha melech. So, if it's a mitzvah, then why are the Jewish people criticized so much for doing it? Why is it a sin? A mitzvah cannot be a sin. And the Nitziv explains the same idea, that had the Jewish people been truly righteous, they would not have needed a human king. They would have just kept the Torah, and Hashem would have given them blessing. And when there was a war, they would appoint a judge. See, that's the difference. Before we had kings, we had individual judges. Now you might say, what exactly is the difference between a shofet and a melech? I mean, is it just a name? I mean, a shofet was like a king. The difference basically is that a shofet is an ad hoc situation. When we have a war, so we appoint someone to lead us into war, but then we go back and we keep the Torah. We don't need kings, we don't need governments. So the ideal Jewish world would be, you don't need a government, because people would be tzaddikim, people would keep the din, people would keep the Torah. That's actually the theory of anarchy. Now there is we call anarchy hefkeris, but the truth is, there is a political philosophy called anarchy, which says that if people would truly be good, you wouldn't need the police. I mean, again, I mean, that's true. Everybody would be righteous. You wouldn't need the police. You wouldn't need the army. You know, you wouldn't need... What's the story, though? A few years ago, there was an anarchist convention in Seattle, Washington. They wanted to have a convention of anarchists, but they couldn't do it. They couldn't get organized for the first session, so it disbanded. Okay. It's true. They couldn't. There was nobody who took charge, so they just couldn't get organized. But okay. So the idea was, if you live in a lawless society where people are not keeping mitzvahs, you're chayav to appoint a king. It's a mitzvah to appoint a king. But Shmuel is saying, it's such a yerida that you've come to the level that you need it. You see? So this is the Nitziv Yesod, that in the ideal world, this would have been an Avera, whether it's sending spies or having a king. But if Lamaisa were not living on that Madrega, it becomes a mandatory Chiv to do it, right? So the Nitziv is a compromise. Rashi says, sending the Meraglim is a sin. And the Ramban says, sending the Meraglim is Hishtadlus. The Nitziv says, sending Meraglim is Hishtadlus, but had we been on a higher level of Emuna, we would not need the Hishtadlus. This is, again, the famous catch-22 that the Chayvas HaLevavas identifies, where the Chayvas HaLevavas says, the stronger your Emuna, the less hishtadlus you need to do in the real world. So paradoxically, if a person doesn't have emunah and says, well, I don't have emunah, I got to do this hishtadlus, it'll become a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're going to have to do more, because there's more hester panim, there's more concealment of the divine. Right? So this is the machlokas, Rashi and the Rambam. Okay. But akoma, and then it saves compromise in the middle. But akomaidim, that even if I say like the Ramban, that the shiluach ha-meraglim was permissible, but akomaidim, that the report of the meraglim and the response of the Jewish people, that certainly was the sin of the meraglim. Now, as you know, the meraglim went for 40 days. The meraglim went for 40 days. And they returned, the calculation of the Gemara is, they returned on the 8th day of Av. The 8th day of the month of Av. They gave their report on the 8th day of Av. And that night, the entire Jewish people, although not the entire, but mentions the nation cried and they moaned and they said that we have no way of succeeding here, that these people will destroy us, that the Canaanites are too powerful. And according to our tradition, Chazal have a Messiah in Torah Shebal Peh, that is why the 9th of Av became a day of Chorban and Bechia. Remember the lesson of the Gemara in Tainus? Atem Bechisem Bechia Shelchina. You cried a cry for no reason. For no reason. This night, the night of Tisha B'Av, will be the night in which there will be crying in all the generations. It was the night, or the day, it was the day, the 9th of Av was the day that the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. It was the day that the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Exactly how many years later? How many years between the destruction of the first Mikdash and the second Mikdash? 490 years. Because between the Chorban Bayis Rishon and the building of the Bayis Sheni is 70 years. And the Bayis Sheni stood 420 years. So from the Chorban Bayis Rishon on the 9th of Av to the Chorban Bayis Sheni on the 9th of Av was 490 years. Same day. Same day. It was Motsoi Shemitah, meaning it was the year after a Shemitah. And it was the Chet HaMeraglim that was Keveya that Tisha B'Av would be the Bechila. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I want to ask. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu send the Nesi'im of the Jewish people? I mean, when you send spies to a land, you don't send the leaders, because probably they can die, then you have to appoint new leaders. You send normal guys, you know, but they send the leaders, I mean.
So Rashi says that Moshe Rabbeinu picked people who were righteous at the time. They were righteous. In other words, he was afraid that people would come back with a negative report, etc. And therefore he wanted Badafka Tzadikim. But it's a very mudden nizach, though, just to add another perspective to your kasha. Because although Moshe Rabbeinu sent Tzadikim, Moshe Rabbeinu seemed to have an intimation that something bad would happen, because this is when he changed Yehoshua's name. Yehoshua was the spy from the tribe of Ephraim. And his name was originally Hosea. Hosea. But Hashem changed his name to Yehoshua. Now the Torah doesn't say why. The Torah just says Moshe called Hosea ben Nun Yehoshua. Why is that? So Rashi explains, because Yud and He are Hashem's name. And he wants to put Hashem's name in Yehoshua's name, and Hoshea means to save. Ka Hoshiacha. May Hashem save you from the evil counsel of the Meraglim. So Moshe had an intimation there would be an evil counsel.
Huh? when Moshe Rabbeinu had a council, yeah. It was not obligatory, it was a reshus, yeah?
Yeah.
So, why to get to go for a risk and to send the Meraglim to spy on the land, even there's a suspicion that the Meraglim will do something bad?
Yeah, so the Netziv is really answering it. The Netziv is really telling us, once the people showed they did not have full faith in Hashem, they needed to do this. Now, first of all, I do want to make one little correction. The spies were very important people, but they were not the Nesi'im. In other words, if you look in Parshas Naso, and you're given the names of the 12 Nesi'im, they are not the same as the 12 spies. These are two different listings. The Nesi'im, the Meraglim were Anshei Shem, they were famous, respected people, but they were not the Nesi'im themselves. There's the Nesi'im and there's the Meraglim, two different lists. Now, it's interesting, Moshe prays for Yahushua, right? He changes Yahushua's name. Why doesn't he change Kalev's name? Like, what is? So, the Mesher Chachma says the following idea. The Mesher Chachma says, Moshe, of course, knows Yahushua is a tzaddik, that Yahushua ben Nun is Moshe Rabbeinu's disciple, Moshe Rabbeinu's Talmud. The Torah describes Yahushua ben Nun as never leaving Moshe's Ohel, even when Har Sinai, when Moshe's the only one who goes to Har Sinai, Yahushua is waiting, right? Yahushua is a little bit on the mountain away from the people, so he could be as close to Moshe as possible. So the Mesher Chachma says, though, that Yahushua ben Nun comes from Shevet Ephraim. Shevet Ephraim is from Yosef. So he says, Yosef had one spiritual weakness, although he's called Yosef HaTzadik. That is, Yosef was vulnerable to Lashon Hara. Why? Because the Torah says, Yosef brought Lashon Hara about his brothers to Yaakov Avinu. So Moshe is afraid that as righteous as Yahushua is, he may be prone to be nichshal in the Lashon Hara, that he might participate in it, and therefore he needed a special prayer. As opposed to Kalev, Moshe was batuach that Kalev would not be nichshal. The Achilles heel of Moshe, of Yosef, is Lashon Hara. The only question is that Yosef has two Shvatim. Yosef has the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Manasseh. Why doesn't Moshe pray also for the Nasi of the tribe of Manasseh? You can see the Lashon of the Pasuk here. Yeah, he doesn't really have a yisha for that. But he does point out that when it lists the Meraglim, in the pasuk about Yahushua, it just calls him Lamate Ephraim, to the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea ben Nun. And it mentions Mate Yosef, Mate Menashe, Gadi ben Susi. So why does it mention Mate Yosef only by Menashe and not Ephraim? The answer is, because the Nasi of Menashe followed the path of Yosef in speaking Lashon Hara, and Yahushua did not because of Moshe's prayer. Well, so that explains why Yahushua is not described as coming from Mate Yosef, but it doesn't explain why Moshe didn't pray for him. The Chafetz Chaim, however, gives another answer. The Chafetz Chaim says the following. The Chafetz Chaim says, and I'm going to modernize this a little bit, that the difference between a Jewish leader, you know, a Torah leader, and a leader outside of Torah world, is that a Torah leader is always a reluctant leader. A Torah leader lives with humility, with modesty, and doesn't want to be a leader. Doesn't want to tell people what to do. Doesn't want to take the responsibility. Feels that Hashem should find somebody better, somebody more worthy. Moshe Rabbeinu himself is the paradigm of the reluctant leader, the one who says that they're not worthy. As opposed to when you have a vice president and a president, and the vice president is saying to Hillam every day that the president should, should resign or die or whatever it is, just to get the job. A leader is someone who doesn't want the job. If you want the job, you're not the right person to be a leader. Now, Yehoshua ben Nun has been designated to be the leader of Am Yisrael when Moshe Rabbeinu dies. Yehoshua ben Nun is going to be the person that's going to replace Moshe Rabbeinu. So when he's in a group of people that are saying, we can't do it, we can't do it, we can't do it, we're not worthy, he's the one that's going to feel that more than anybody else, because he's demonic. And therefore he needed a special prayer, and he still needed Siyata Dishmaya. In fact, I let me backtrack a little bit, because I didn't develop this idea. Part of the thought is that the taina of the Meraglim is that we don't have the merits to go to Eretz Yisrael, because we're going to lose Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is going to die. Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't enter Eretz Yisrael. So how can we possibly be victorious without Moshe Rabbeinu? Well, who is going to feel the greatest inadequacy when the line goes, without Moshe we're nobody? Yehoshua ben Nun. He was the most vulnerable to that line, and as a result, Moshe Rabbeinu had to Vidavka give him that tefillah. This is how the Chafetz Chaim understands it. In other words, the whole Hesber here is that it is already known, this is critical, it is already known that the Jewish people, I'm sorry, that Moshe Rabbeinu is not going to enter Eretz Yisrael. Now you may ask the question, what do you mean? How do people know that? The sin for which Moshe Rabbeinu does not enter Eretz Yisrael is because he hit the rock instead of speaking to the rock. But that didn't take place yet. As far as they know, maybe Moshe will go to Eretz Yisrael with them. But we actually see that although Moshe Rabbeinu didn't do a chet yet, it was already known publicly he was not going to enter Eretz Yisrael. How do I know this? Do you remember last week, Parshas Baloscha? So Moshe Rabbeinu finally designates 70 members of the Sanhedrin who will kind of take his place when he dies. These are the Zechanim. Yehoshua is the leader, but there'll be 70 Sanhedrin. And how do you get 70 elders? So if you remember the way it works, each Shevet designated 6 members. Now 12 times 6 is 72. So you got a problem here, because the Sanhedrin is 70, but there's a total of 72 people that were chosen. So they put like slips of paper in a like lottery, and 70 slips basically said, Dayan, Dayan, you're a judge, you're a judge, you're a judge. And 2 slips were blank, so people would draw, and then there'd be 2 people that would be disqualified. And in the Chumash it says that Eldad Umedad separated themselves as if they were not chosen. But in reality, it was through their humility, meaning to say they actually were chosen, but the people who were not chosen refused to identify themselves. So Eldad Umedad excluded themselves. And if you remember, Yehoshua comes to Moshe. This is last week's Parsha. Yesterday's Parsha. And Yehoshua says, Eldad Umedad are prophesying. Moshe, put them in jail. They're prophesying. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, Halavai, that all of Am Yisrael would be prophets. So Rashi raises the question, what is Yehoshua screaming about? So they're prophesying. What is so bad? So Rashi says, it was not that they were prophets, that was okay, but what it was they were saying. They were saying, Moshe meis, Moshe's gonna die, the Yehoshua machnis, and Yehoshua is going to bring the Jewish people to Eretz Yisrael. And Yehoshua, instead of being happy, says to Moshe, arrest them. So what is the point I'm making? Even before the chait of hitting the rock, Am Yisrael already knows from Elder Umeda that Moshe is going to die. Now, if you take that in mind, you can now understand why they are so frightened with the description of the Canaan, because they feel without Moshe Rabbeinu, we are not worthy. And who is going to feel the most unworthiness? Yehoshua ben Nun. And because of his humility, because he's the one that's going to take Moshe's place. And that is why Moshe had to make a special prayer to be Mechazek Yehoshua. In a way, you see the greatness of the Jewish leader. Kalev has faith in Yehoshua. So Kalev doesn't need the prayer. Yehoshua doesn't have faith in himself. That's why he needs the special tefillah. By the way, if you know, the other thing that Rashi says, so Yehoshua comes in and says, Adoni Moshe, Master Moshe, Kilo'aim. Now Kilo'aim is translated, put them in prison. It's interesting, there was a jail, right? Put them in prison. But Rashi brings another interpretation. Kilo'aim means destroy them. And that could mean, if they're prophets, give them a position of Tzorchei Tzibur, and that'll destroy them. That'll take away their energy in and of itself. Right? It's like you say, the worst job for somebody who wants to learn is a Rosh Hashiva. Think about that. I know somebody who could have been a Rosh Hashiva. Instead, he remained a stockbroker. He said he wanted to have more time to learn. Rosh Hashiva collecting money, you know. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, they want to be prophets. Give them a position of authority, and that will take away their prophecy. Yeah. So that's the idea. So again, the site of the Chet HaMeraglim was a lack of emunah in Hashem, but ultimately it also meant a lack of emunah that we could be zoche to Hashem's hashkacha without a Moshe Rabbeinu. Right. That's really it. And that's very, very key. So you have to remember that the Meraglim story is very makusher to the nevuah of Eldad Umeidad Misnabdim B'machaneh, that they said Moshe Meis and Yehoshua Machaneh. Okay, maybe we'll stop there.